Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. The availability, advertising, and use of contraceptives have been among the most controversial topics in American history. And as our guest this week, Andrea Tone, has written in her recent book on the subject, that controversy did not begin with the invention of oral contraceptives in the 20th century. And after that, John Hagen, author of Northern Passage, joins us to talk about the fate of American draft resistors who moved to Canada rather than fight in the Vietnam War. But first, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On June 17, 1885, Liberty Enlightening the World arrived in New York City. The idea for the Statue of Liberty, as it is known, came from French historian Edouard de La Boulaye. The French people contributed funds, and in 1875, sculptor Frederick Bartholdi began work. He constructed the statue of copper sheets, hammered into shape by hand and assembled over a framework of four gigantic steel supports designed by a team that included Alexander Gustave Eiffel, who designed the Eiffel Tower. When completed, the Statue of Liberty measured more than 151 feet in height and weighed 225 tons. The American architect Richard Morris Hunt designed the pedestal on which the statue was erected on Bedloe's Island, and President Grover Cleveland dedicated the completed project on October 28, 1886. The Statue of Liberty was originally intended to celebrate the Declaration of Independence, accounting for the inscription of the date July 4, 1776, on the tablet held by Lady Liberty. But the statue is more commonly associated with American immigration, emphasized by the sonnet inscribed on its pedestal, The New Colossus by Emma Lazarus, which reads in part, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." Turning to an item of historical interest in the news, in 1888, James Dean, a Howard University Law College graduate, defeated two white opponents and became the first black county judge elected in the South after Reconstruction. He was 32 years old. 1 year later, he was pulled from the Monroe County bench. His crime, he issued a marriage license to a white man and a black woman, an illegal procedure in Florida at the time. Dean died 25 years later, destitute and forgotten, that is, until now. Attorney Calvin Allen took up Dean's case 3 years ago and has succeeded in persuading Florida Governor Jeb Bush to reinstate Dean as a Monroe County judge, thereby restoring his reputation. This is Talking History. Contraception may be commonplace today, but that has not always been the case. In the third quarter of the 19th century, Margaret Sanger sought to give women more control over their bodies and was jailed for her effort. In 1873, Congress passed a law that criminalized the birth control business. It's an interesting history explored this week by Talking History's Fred Nielsen and his guest, Andrea Tone.
In the United States, 80% of the women born after 1945 have used oral contraceptives. These drugs are manufactured by large pharmaceutical companies, prescribed by doctors, and regulated by the federal government. It was not always so. In 1873, Congress declared that information about birth control was obscene. Making, selling, or advertising contraceptives was a criminal offense. Here to discuss how the birth control business evolved from the black market of the 19th century to the mass market of today is Andrea Tone, a professor of history at Georgia Tech. She is the author of Devices and Desires, A History of Contraceptives in America. Professor Tone, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
In 1873, Congress passed the Comstock Act, which criminalized the birth control business. The law took its name from a New York moral reformer, Anthony Comstock. What was his objection to contraceptives?
Well, I think it's really easy sometimes to dismiss Anthony Comstock as just a raving lone lunatic who hated birth control, and we are then tempted to think that everybody else in the United States at this time supported it. In fact, it's a little more complicated than that. Comstock was a devout Congregationalist who believed, as did many Americans at the time, that birth control needed to be seen as part of a growing and highly visible traffic in sexual vice. And this was a traffic that included birth control devices, but that also included pornographic items, jewelry trinkets, dirty pictures of boys and girls and adults, and he saw birth control as, you know, part of this larger business that he felt would corrode the morals of the nation's youth. The other thing that was part of his ideology and the ideology of many other people at this time was a belief that pregnancy was the only break on human lust, that you had to have pregnancy as a natural byproduct of a sexual union if social order was to be maintained. And without that really threat of pregnancy lurking on the horizon, men and women would engage in promiscuous sexual acts without dangerous to the social and sexual order.
Have laws, but what were their practical effect? Did the Comstock Law change people's behavior?
It didn't change people's behavior, at least not on the consumption side, by which I mean after 1873, although the birth control business, as you say, was now criminal, manufacturers and retailers continue to make and sell birth control, but they disguise their products under legally proper euphemisms. So products that had previously been openly marketed as condoms or caps were now called things like male shields or rubber goods for gents. And consumers could kind of slog through those euphemisms and being advertised to them. And they continued to birth control throughout the period of criminalization. But one of the unfortunate consequences of criminalization was that it meant that products that were sold on the black market were sold without the benefit of any consumer protections in place. Because, of course, if something's considered criminal in the eyes of the government, then consumers who are taking part in those criminal activities are not going to be given the benefit of government regulation.
Big established businesses didn't want to be associated with contraceptive devices now that the devices were illegal. That left the market open for enterprising entrepreneurs.
Yes, and one of my favorite characters in this book is one of those entrepreneurs, a man by the name of Julius Schmidt, who comes to the United States in the 1880s from Germany. He's penniless. He ends up sleeping on park benches in New York for several days, finally finds a job at a sausage casing company, and he is dealing every day in animal intestines, and he saves a reserve and uses those intestines to open a bootleg condom enterprise, because some of the earliest condoms were made out of animal intestines. And by the 1930s, birth control, if it has a medicinal purpose, has been declared illegal, and Schmidt crops up in the pages of Fortune magazine, kind of the epitome of American capitalism, as the king of the condom empire. So over the course of several decades, he goes from a penniless immigrant to a millionaire who's, you know, going around being escorted in a very fancy truck.
One of the things that seems to help his business and condom manufacturers generally is World War I. The military's experience there suggested that birth control aside, these were products that needed to be used.
Right. We in the United States had a very bad problem with venereal disease transmission during World War I, and that was because the United States was the only country that did not allow condoms as an official issue item. All of the other allied nations not only supported condom use, they actually distributed condoms free of charge to soldiers. The official policy in the United States was abstinence, and that was because many people in the military and many moralists feared that the mere availability of condoms would increase sexual promiscuity. So it kind of harks back to some of the arguments that Comstock had made in the 1870s. What happened, unfortunately, was only a minority of our doughboys were abstinent, but they didn't have any proper goods on them to prevent disease transmission. So our infection rate was much higher than that of any other country, and in the aftermath of World War I, we ended up as taxpayers in this country spending millions and millions of dollars treating the men who were denied condoms during World War I and who then contracted syphilis or gonorrhea. So to answer your original question, what happens as a result of all of this is that finally in 1918, a court decision comes out of New York which says that articles that have birth control properties, but which can chiefly be considered devices that protect against the transmission of disease or treat medical disorders, do have legal legitimacy. And this is an exception that applied most directly to condoms, which do prevent pregnancy but also prevent STDs.
One of the central figures in the birth control movement, one of the advocates for birth control, was, of course, Margaret Sanger. Now, she began by wanting to give women more control over their bodies, but along the way she seems to have shifted approaches, ultimately inaugurating, as you put it, a regime of doctors, diaphragms, and corporate science. What led her to change her mind?
Well, Sanger is such an interesting case. She starts out being very committed to the idea of grassroots birth control, of women learning how their bodies work, of relying on over-the-counter methods and teaching each other how to use them effectively. What happens, though, is Sanger clashes with the law after she opens the very first birth control clinic in this country in 1916. She is arrested, and there's a very sensationalist trial, and she's stigmatized as being part of the radical group promoting birth control. And what she decides to do is to make a deal, to forge an alliance with the medical profession, trying to move birth control from a radical left-wing movement to a respectable middle-class one. And she realizes the only way to make this transition is to get the support of doctors and the scientific community. So when the court ruling that I referred to earlier that came out of New York in 1918 passes, she uses that legal cover, which is that, you know, as long as you are using birth control for medicinal purposes, then birth control can be considered legal. She uses that to open up the first permanent medical birth control clinic, which opens in New York in 1923. And at this point, she's realized that the only way she can bring birth control to the masses is to go through medical channels. Now, one of the unfortunate byproducts of that decision to consciously seek out the support of doctors is that by opting for a medical route, she ironically ensured that fewer women had access to birth control, because what we know about birth control usage patterns after the 1920s is that even though medically approved and medically prescribed birth control becomes available as a result of her actions, most women still feel very uncomfortable seeing a doctor to get doctor-prescribed methods such as the diaphragm, which is the one that Sanger and her doctor allies favored. Or many women did not have the financial resources to consult a doctor, or some of them were not able to overcome regional obstacles to see a doctor. Sometimes doctors were just too far away. So on the one hand, we can say Sanger's change helped birth control's status throughout the nation, and I think that's fair. But on the other hand, one of the unfortunate consequences is that it made birth control more respectable, but it also sent a larger proportion of women back to over-the-counter methods.
How does the pill change things?
It changes things in a number of ways. The FDA approves the pill in 1960, and it's the first time that doctors become the chief providers of birth control, first of all. Sanger wasn't responsible for medicalizing birth control in the sense that after her involvement, most women see doctors, as I said. The pill does change that, though. If you're going to get this phenomenally effective and relatively safe new method, you have to see a doctor. So it makes birth control the province of physicians for the first time. It also feminizes birth control in ways that had not been before. Before the pill was approved, the number one method of birth control in this country was condoms. So we see a kind of gender shift that occurs after 1960. And we also find that, you know, for the first time, many women felt truly free to practice birth control without worry, without any mess, without having to consult your male partner. It's for so many women, I think, really quite liberating.
Some contraceptives not only fail to work, you talk about in the early days people being so unsure of their efficacy that they're using two, three, even four separate approaches at the same time. But even more, some of the devices and techniques have been appallingly dangerous as you discuss them. And that includes some of the most popular, from caustic feminine hygiene products in the 30s, 40s, and 50s to the Dalkon Shield more recently. What accounts for that high level of danger?
I think part of it was the absence of effective government regulations. The 1918 decision that I referred to earlier makes birth control legal, but it doesn't set up any kind of government protection agency to double check that what's being sold to consumers is safe and effective. For condoms, that doesn't occur until the late 1930s when the FDA finally gets involved in their regulation. And some of those records, I need to tell your listeners, are just so much fun to go through. They're all housed at the FDA History Office. And they're essentially the records of condom raids that were staged by the FDA without advance notice, where agents would just go into condom factories and hold up to the light, you know, hundreds, sometimes thousands of condoms to check for holes and other imperfections. But even as the FDA gets involved in condom regulation, there is no comparable agency looking at female contraceptives. The FDA did not consider pregnancy prevention to be something worthy of its attention because it wasn't preventing disease. It was only preventing pregnancy, and those two were not seen as the same thing. So it takes much longer for the government to get involved with the regulation of female contraceptives. And you know, the Dalkon Shield is a very good example of how long it takes for the government to get involved in the regulation of some kinds of female birth control over others. So, for instance, when the pill is approved, the new drug application submitted by its manufacturer, G.D. Searle, had to clear all sorts of hoops at the FDA. The Dalkon Shield, though, was different. It was an IUD, so it's considered a medical device rather than a medical drug. And at the time that the Dalkon Shield was marketed in the early 1970s, there were no mechanisms in place at the FDA to force the company that manufactured the Dalkon Shield, AH Robbins, to clear the same kind of hoops that G.D. Searle had to do with the pill. There was no pre-market scrutiny. So that meant that the FDA could only get involved in bringing the sort of alarming experiences of women with the Dalkon Shield to the attention of the manufacturer until after the fact. And that meant there was a really large lag time, roughly 3 years, before the Dalkon Shield was taken off the market. Fortunately, we as a society have learned from that very painful and costly mistake with the Dalkon Shield, and shortly after the shield was removed from the marketplace, new legislation was passed making sure that the FDA was involved in the pre-market clearance of medical devices, including IUDs, as well as other kinds of female contraceptives. But I'd say regulation has historically been the chief obstacle in the way of consumer safety, and that the problem with regulation is related directly to the criminal status of birth control for such a long time in our history.
We have only a few seconds remaining. The majority of contraceptive devices and drugs that you discuss have been for use by women, not men, and I'm wondering how we should understand that. Is that a matter of science or more of a matter of attitudes rooted in history?
That's a good question. I would say it's a bit of both. I'm hopeful that there are some new male methods that will be available soon, or at least this is what I've been promised by scientists who are active in this field. But I think it does relate to social attitudes over time. Margaret Sanger, for instance, felt that the key to female liberation was female control over birth control, that without it, women would be forced to depend on the will and responsibility of men, and she had some pretty nasty things to say about male reliability in this domain. And, you know, it's interesting. I think when I talk to my female students at Georgia Tech and I tell them about the male methods that are undergoing clinical trials today, they seem delighted at the prospect of men sharing this burden and having to put up with some of the side effects that women have had to put up with for decades. But they're also reluctant to trust men to use birth control. And their argument makes a certain amount of sense, and that is that only women get pregnant, and women in our society still perform the lion's share of child-rearing. So if a man forgets to take his pill or doesn't show up for his quarterly injection, women are going to bear the responsibility and cost of that mistake. So I think it's just not clear-cut at all.
Well, Professor Tone, thanks so much for visiting with us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Andrea Tone, the author of Devices and Desires, A History of Contraceptives in America.
In our interview this week, Andrea Tone spoke of Margaret Sanger. For our site of the week, we'd like to call your attention to a most unusual museum where you can learn more about Sanger and many other prominent women in American history. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Women's History Museum on Wheels contains artifacts, documents, and genuine memorabilia from more than 20 historic women who were reformers, activists, and women who made a difference. Included in the exhibit are signed letters, photographs, recorded voices, and more from Clara Barton, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Susan B. Anthony, and Margaret Sanger, just to name a few. You can visit the Mobile Museum in West Liberty, West Virginia, or you can have the museum come to see you. The museum is a recommended site by the National Women's History Project.
During the era of the Vietnam War, thousands of Americans fled to Canada rather than fight in the war. The movement is usually seen as a short-lived, individualized spin-off of the anti-war movement. But after the war ended, and even after they were allowed to return home, more than half of those who left the U.S. chose to stay in Canada. In this week's commentary, John Hagen reflects on the history of those expatriates.
More than 30 years ago, as Americans divided over the Vietnam War, more than 50,000 draft-age men and women migrated to Canada in the largest political exodus since the American Revolution. Many of the draft and military resistors came to Toronto, to a city that offered them acceptance without question, and offered shelter as well in neighborhoods such as the one that came to be known affectionately as the American Ghetto. After the war, as amnesty took root, about half returned to the United States, but the other half stayed, forging successful lives in Canada while maintaining connections to the United States. Today, the durability of those connections is clearer than ever. So, too, is the extent to which these draft resistors and the women who came with them have prospered, not just personally, but also by helping to shape Toronto in myriad ways. A few examples. Peter Milligan played a prominent part in imposing a height limit on new buildings, which helped preserve older neighborhoods. Bill King, a resistor who played in Janis Joplin's band, became the artistic director of the Toronto Beaches Jazz Festival, one of the city's most joyful celebrations. The list goes on. Andy Berry has given an articulate new voice to Canadian public radio. Eric Nagler became one of Canada's best-known writers and performers of children's songs. And John Thompson contributed to the design of the recent streetcar corridor that connects the Bloor Street subway line with the new harbor front. The American expatriates say their career choices, as with almost everything else about their lives in Canada, were changed by their decision to leave the United States. And those choices are easily defined. The U.S. transplants have, more than most, devoted themselves to social and political activism, working in healthcare, cultural, and human service fields. Yet for all their integration into Canada, and for all the fondness that resistors feel for their adopted country, there is still an American side to the story. In my interviews with more than 100 Toronto resistors, almost all said they traveled in the United States in the previous year, and still communicate by phone, email, letter, or through friends with family members and friends here. A majority said they would consider moving back to the United States in the future, and nearly half of the resistors who have stayed maintain dual Canadian-U.S. citizenship. Tom Needham is typical. Like the overwhelming majority of Toronto resistors, Needham feels very Canadian now. He says his decision to move to Canada was the best thing I ever did. I'm sure of it. Still, Needham also expresses a mixed sense of identity that many resistors living in Canada feel today. On the one hand, he notes that I became a Canadian quite easily and willingly, almost the same way my father became an American instead of an Irishman. Gradually, I knew more and more people. I was hanging around with Canadians, and my wife is Canadian. On the other hand, there is still also a sense of residual Americanness that neither Needham nor his wife would wish him to lose. I have lots of things I still like about the USA, he says. I was in Boston recently, and just the ethnic food in ordinary places, baseball, bourbon, and the blues are still my favorites. Many resistors have forged a new kind of blended identity. They feel no need to declare total allegiance to old country or new, and are happy maintaining continuing ties to both. Their worlds have expanded.
You've been listening to John Hagen, Professor of Sociology and Law at Northwestern University and the University of Toronto. Hagen is the author of Northern Passage, American Vietnam War Resistors in Canada. This is Talking History. And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we alert you to a major Native arts exhibit at Stanford University. When a group of New England explorers set out more than 200 years ago, they brought back souvenirs from the indigenous people they encountered, hoping to inspire later generations. The East India Marine Society gathered so many baskets, masks, blankets, headdresses, weapons, and other American Indian items that it established a museum in Salem, Massachusetts in 1825 to hold it all. Today, the Peabody Essex Museum has more than 20,000 pieces in its Native American collection, but it can display only a fraction of them, a problem curators of the exhibit hope to correct. 100 items collected from the indigenous peoples of North and South America are included in Uncommon Legacies, Native American art from the Peabody Essex Museum, on view at Stanford's Iris and B. Gerald Cantor's Center for Visual Arts. The show, full of rarely seen treasures from the 17th through the 20th centuries, tries to erase stereotypes and ethnocentric viewpoints by depicting the everyday lives of Indians, said Tom Hocus, a Lakota artist from the Rosebud Sioux Reservation in South Dakota, who was a consultant on the show. We're trying to de-romanticize, to show the breadth of our cultures and still present pieces of great aesthetic appeal, he added. Reality is sitting at home. Uncommon Legacies will be on display at Stanford University's Cantor Center for Visual Arts in Palo Alto, California, through August 11th. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.